From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth, the husband and wife rhythm section of the Talking Heads and the leaders of the band Tom Tom Club. Language is both beautiful and treacherous to David Shields. He's a novelist who has a stutter. Coming up, we talk about Dead Languages, Shields' semi-autobiographical novel. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the New Music America Festival, and TV critic David Bianculli reviews the latest edition of Public TV's documentary series, POV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush was heckled today by opponents of U.S. policy toward El Salvador during a campaign pitch for a Republican candidate in Illinois. Bush was interrupted by a woman who yelled, "Why are we sending money to El Salvador? Why are we killing priests in El Salvador?" The president denied the accusation and told the woman to be quiet. The woman was escorted by security guards out of the room and later arrested. The House today refused to temporarily hold back some of El Salvador's $85 million in military aid over the killing of six Jesuit priests last week. Lawmakers approved a $14.6 billion foreign aid measure, which also carries assistance to Poland and Hungary. Congress is still trying to work out a compromise on two issues before it adjourns, a Medicare catastrophic health plan repeal and a deficit reduction bill. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Medicare Catastrophic Illness Act is, as wags on Capitol Hill put it, in a coma. The House yesterday reaffirmed its position that the whole law should be repealed. Supporters of repeal say they represent the sentiments of millions of elderly people who decided they didn't like the law after they realized they would have to pay an income-based surtax for the coverage. The Senate favors a different plan to drop the surtax and scale back the benefits, but keep some benefits intact in exchange for a small annual premium. Negotiators are still looking for a compromise, and both houses are working with the White House trying to come to grips with another problem, a plan for deficit reduction. President Bush has asked Congress for a $14 billion deficit reduction plan, and Congress must stay in session until it comes up with one that he will sign. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of the East German city of Leipzig today in what has become a weekly demonstration against the ruling Communist Party. Sylvia Poggioli has more from Leipzig.
About 100,000 protesters gathered in Karl Marx Square this afternoon to call for the punishment of crimes committed by Communist Party leaders. Several speakers denounced what they called four decades of lies and deceptions by the Communist Party, accused of causing the country's economic and environmental collapse. Later, the crowd marched through the city, yelling slogans and carrying candles. The rally followed a prayer of peace, which has been held every Monday since early October in Nikolai Church. About 2,500 people attended the service, and for the first time today, seven other churches hosted similar gatherings. Churchgoers praised nonviolence and expressed solidarity with protesters in Czechoslovakia. For National Public Radio, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Leipzig.
More than 200,000 people marched in the streets of Prague today demanding free elections in Czechoslovakia, and state-run television reported for the first time in decades protests broke out in other cities in Czechoslovakia as well. This is NPR News. A Miami jury heard the fourth day of testimony today in the manslaughter trial of William Lozano, a Hispanic police officer who is accused of shooting a black motorcyclist last January, provoking riots. As Jeff White reports, the defense scored some points today.
The defense claims that Officer Lozano shot the motorcyclist in self-defense as the bike was headed directly toward him at a high rate of speed. Today, jurors were told by a county medical examiner that Clement Lloyd, the motorcycle driver, had alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine in his system at the time he died. Prosecutors attempted to downplay this, asking expert witness Dr. Herbert Moskowitz what effect the cocaine would have had on Lloyd's behavior.
I have an opinion. Yes, in my opinion, it's not at all.
It would not have affected his driving?
Absolutely not at all.
How would it have affected his driving?
Nothing.
The Lozano trial is receiving a lot of media coverage in Miami. One public TV station is videotaping each day's proceedings and airing them during prime time. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
The Vice Chief of Naval Operations said today the recent series of Navy accidents that have claimed 9 lives since late October has affected recruiting. The rash of accidents prompted the Navy last week to order an unprecedented stand-down from most routine training to allow a review of basic safety and operating procedures. The Navy has counted 101 operation and training-related fatalities between January 1st and November 1st, including the explosion aboard the USS Iowa in April that killed 47 sailors. Defense Secretary Richard Cheney today reportedly analyzed a possible budget package that would include $20 billion in military spending cuts next year. Cheney also held more than 4 hours of conferences with the Pentagon civilian leadership, the chiefs of the armed services, and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Colin Powell, in which they reviewed the military suggestions for dealing with Cheney's orders to cut spending by $180 billion between 1992 and 94. I'm Frank Stasio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The band Talking Heads started playing New York punk clubs in the mid-70s, and as rock critic Ken Tucker has written, the band came to symbolize New York new wave at its naughtiest. Their initially terse, squawking, demonic sound summed up all that was eccentric and anti-commercial about the lower Manhattan scene. Talking Heads is still together and has become one of the most innovative bands of the past decade. My guests are the band's drummer, Chris Franz, and bassist, Tina Weymouth. They're married and have 2 children. Since 1980, in addition to their work with Talking Heads, they've had their own band, Tom Tom Club, which had a couple of dance hits. Last winter, Tom Tom Club released an album called Boom Boom Cha Boom Boom, and this is the opening track. Franz and Tina Weymouth, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe to us why you formed this group.
One day we woke up and we found out we didn't have any money in the bank. And so we decided better get to work. And this is because even though the Talking Heads was doing really well, we had gone on the road with a band of 9 people or something like that, and we were traveling in airplanes everywhere and staying in fancy hotels and things like that, and we did a very successful tour which made no money, in fact almost put us into the hole. And so David was doing this thing called the Catherine Wheel on Broadway, and Jerry Harrison was doing an album called The Red and the Black, a solo album, and Tina and I said to each other, we better think of something to do. And we went to a friend named Chris Blackwell, who owns Island Records, and he said, I'll give you a chance that you can make a single, and if the single does well, then you can make an entire album. And we thought that was a nice, fair offer. And so we made the single, and I think it went to number one in 7 countries. It was called Wordy Rapping Hood, and it was a prototypical rap song or homage to rap music, which at that time, we're talking 1980, was still a new and, as you would say, fresh type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then that led to an album, and then that led to a second album, and then Talking Heads got real busy and with movies and tours and things like that, and so there was no time for Tom Tom Club anymore, but now Talking Heads is like a band that makes an album every other year, so we got loads of time for the Tom Tom Club, and we're I guess you could say we're pretty much starting over like a new band.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about how you first got together, how Talking Heads first got together. You were both students at the Rhode Island School of Design,
in the 70s when, I think when you met.
And, that's correct.
And also when you started playing together. What was the balance in your lives between art and music? Did you see yourselves heading in more visual art directions or music directions when you were in college?
Well, I was always doing both. I actually performed at the World's Fair in 1964 as a child. I was a handbell ringer. That's pretty funny, isn't it? And I loved that, you know, and I always loved the stage and performance. And but at the same time, I was studying art at the Corcoran. This was in Washington, D.C., and one of my teachers was Mark Rothko, who's just about my favorite painter in the world. And I was always doing both, and I think that's true for Chris as well, wasn't it, Chris?
Yes. I started playing music when I was in, I guess, the second or third grade, something like that. I started off, I didn't have English handbells at my school. We had flutophones. We started off on the flutophone. And one thing led to another, and I ended up playing drums in the school band, you know, marching in the football games and the Memorial Day parades. And then something happened. The Beatles came out, and every kid that could play music was started forming groups in their basement and playing Beatles songs and Venture songs and, you know, Dave Clark Five songs and Louie Louie and stuff like that. And this was a continuing interest, although I never really believed that I could actually make a living playing music, especially rock and roll. It seemed to me that was a different breed of person than what I was. Like, that was somebody who grew up in Memphis, you know, or Liverpool, or in the 60s, San Francisco, you know. I was living in Pittsburgh and practicing in my basement, and the chances seemed pretty remote that I would become a rock star. Uh-huh. To me. Well, one thing led to another, and I went to college, and Tina and I met David Byrne, and we started playing together. At least David and I did in a band, and that later became the Talking Heads when we moved to New York.
Yeah, we wrote a song together in our studio called Psycho Killer. David came to us with some lyrics. He said, "I've been approaching people and they won't help me with this because they think it's too morbid a subject." So we said, "Well, we'll help you. We understand what this is about." He said, "I want it to be sort of like Alice Cooper." And so we wrote that song,
this is true. He said he wanted it to be like Alice Cooper.
So this is how you first met with him, when he approached you to write the song?
No, actually, I first met him a couple years before that, when we were freshmen, and he was panhandling and playing the violin with a friend of his who played the accordion in front of the school refectory, they called it. He did this routine where he had a little bird perched on the bow of his violin. You may have seen that in cartoons, but this was in real life. And you know, we formed a little band called the Artistics, and we would play at the Valentine's Day ball and events like that.
So so David Byrne asked you both to work with him on Psycho Killer. What did you each contribute to it?
I think Chris contributed a verse, and I contributed a bridge and part of a verse.
Uh-huh. Well, why don't we play the record?
Sure.
This is from the Talking Heads' first album. This is Psycho Killer.
I'm tense and nervous.
That's Psycho Killer, and my guests are Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth. You know, it's such a great record, and one of the things that's really striking about it is that you've got this almost dance-like beat with this really nervous vocal. it's this great combination.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the really interesting things about Talking Heads, though, you know, especially in the early days, it seemed like an odd grouping in a way. You know, this rhythmic beat and a really nervous singer on top of it.
Yeah, well, everybody always said, oh, you want to be in a band, you've got to be different. So having been trained as artists, we sought to be different, and we also sought to work within the limitations of our playing abilities.
Well, let's talk about the limitations of your playing abilities. Tina, when you started playing with the Talking Heads, you had barely played much bass before.
I had not played bass at all. I had taught myself to play guitar and flute, and of course, I was an English handbell ringer. And I had sung, you know, in school, you know, chorales and stuff, but it was a new thing. But then I just did what every, you know, kid does when they want to start a band. I got my amp, I got my bass guitar, and I had a car. And so I was in, you know, and they had approached many bass players, and they just took one look at Chris and David, and they said, oh, you don't look right. You don't wear platform glitter shoes, and you have short hair. And so I said, well, look, you know, train me. Actually, it was Chris who really kind of pushed it.
Was there ever any objection to Tina playing, since she was a real newcomer to bass? Any dissension in the band about it?
Well, the band,
it wasn't
my band
playing.
At that
it was because I was a girl.
The band at that time was just me and David. So, until Tina joined, and so he said, "Yeah, we'll give it a try," something like that, and we did, and. You know, once in a while, David and Tina would have a little argument about something, or a big argument about something, but it was never anything that was irreparable. And, I mean, if anybody thought that she couldn't do it, clearly they were wrong.
But, Tina, let's get back to what you were just saying, that you were the girl in the band. Now, usually a woman in a rock band is, I don't know whether... they're sometimes forced into it, but frequently it's this like sex goddess image or earth mother image. But you really had neither of those images in the band. I remember seeing you in 1978, and you just stood there and played, and everybody in the band was dressed in a t-shirt and jeans, as I remember. But there was no special woman of the band image that you cultivated.
No, I was trying to avoid that because
we're working on that now.
I was.
We're getting the woman thing together here.
I was thinking that it might be nice for women to see a woman who was just doing her bit, you know.
It was, by the way, very nice.
And I thought it was nice that I wasn't up at the front.
Right. So you are up at the front now. Are you changing your image for that? This is in Tom Top Club we're talking.
Yeah, I guess we are. Well, for one thing, I like to see people really have a good time, and so. I know that if I'm fronting the band and I don't move around, that means everyone else, as what they call supporting players, but they're really just as important, everyone else can't move either, because then it doesn't look good. And so so now I'm very, very physical so that they can be very, very free, you know, to improvise, to act spontaneously. I always appreciated performances by James Brown, by Iggy Pop. Way of showing their love and generosity for the public was by behaving in a very physical manner. So that image has changed. I'm no longer the young, classy admiral's daughter, would-be debutante. You know, I think now I'm a little bit closer to being one possessed at times. but I think that. It's still not sexual, because I always hated that wimpy thing of girl bands, and I didn't like the masculine image either. I didn't think that was appropriate for women or natural, and I didn't want to do anything that felt unnatural.
Well, you know, you mentioned the sexual thing. I think a lot of times bands play off of any sexual energy they can generate between each other, and whether it's, you know, the guitarist and the bass player together, or, you know, a singer and the guitarist or whatever. And here you are in the band, actually married, and from the times I've seen Talking Heads, there isn't any of that sexual interplay. It's just very straightforward music.
Right. We avoided it, the sex thing.
We have the sexual interplay after the show.
I think we were avoiding it because we were trying to find our own niche, you know, in music. And if you look around, you're still laughing. That's great.
Sorry, that was a cheap shot, Terry.
If you look around, you can you see that most of the music that's selling today is music that successfully merchandises sex on television.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really too much to do with music. But Talking Heads, we always wanted it to be about something larger than just about sex.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guests are Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth, the rhythm section of the band Talking Heads. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth are my guests. They're from the band Talking Heads. They also have their own group, Tom Tom Club. Tina, you described yourself as an admiral's daughter, a would-be debutante. Chris, I think your father was in the military also, wasn't he?
Yes, he's a retired general.
When you first got started with Talking Heads, you were playing at places like CBGB's, where it was like the center of the punk scene. One of your first tours was with the Ramones. And I was wondering what kind of affinity you felt with the punk bands that you were grouped together with.
We felt that we were on the outside looking in and that we weren't part of the mainstream, and these other punk kids weren't either. In fact, we were in an interview for punk issue number one, and we were the first to say, we have no heroes, you know, we don't think you have to be a technical virtuoso in order to play and to sound good. So that we shared with all the punks was the idea that the art is in the delivery and in the, you know, the message, and it's not necessarily that you have to, you know, get to Carnegie Hall in order to get your point across. And it was a very nice statement too that was being made, which was that anybody can do this. If you've got something to say, you can get up and do it.
Chris, how do you think Talking Heads has changed over the years musically?
Well, we've made these quantum leaps from time to time. At the moment, we haven't played together for over a year.
Right.
So I don't feel real great about that, but I have to tell you, the next time we get together, it's going to be a situation where we practically have to learn to play all over again. But what happened was we started off being really raw and really raggedy, but we played with great feeling, and somehow we got over on our feelings, because our feelings were maybe a little bit how should I say, undisguised by the usual trappings of show business. And then we one day we realized, hey, we're a lot better now, and we started to be able to, we added Jerry Harrison for one thing, and so we became a quartet instead of a trio, and we made a big leap ahead. Like, our sound got a lot better, and our confidence was better as well. And we sort of stayed on that plateau for a couple of years, and then we did an album called Remain in Light, which more or less changed the way people, at least in our sphere of influence, thought about music. About popular music, that is. In other words, we incorporated a lot of elements that were not to do with rock and roll, but we kept a lot that were. So it was kind of like an African rock and roll, I hate to use that word, fusion, but it was a melding of different influences. And it was a dramatic quantum leap again for us, because it kind of took things to the next phase, as they say. But by the time we did that this tour, which became the movie Stop Making Sense, we had refined our technique and also in, increased our, like, all singing, all dancing performance so that it was really happening.
Did watching yourselves and Stop Making Sense, the movie, have a big impact on you? I don't know how much you'd seen yourself perform before.
Huh, that's a good question.
Yeah, it had a big impact on me in that I could now understand why people were saying, "Oh, that was a great show. That was a great show." Because a lot of times when you're up there playing, you might not feel that great. Like you might even have the flu or something like that. But you have to go on, and particularly from a drummer's point of view, you're seeing the show in reverse, sort of. See everybody's backsides,
right.
You know. So it was very exciting for me to see how it built from the beginning to the end. And it was nice.
Well, it's always a shock, you know, because you know what they say, my face I don't mind it, for I am behind it. It's the others in front that I jar. So that's always kind of a shock, you know, especially because, you know, as being a woman, I'm sure you can understand this. There's, you know, you grow up as a little girl, you think, well, one day you're going to grow up to be a princess. And somewhere along the way you find out, oh, I'm not going to be the beautiful princess. And I learned, you know, that I was going to have to work really, really hard. I imagined myself as having to support myself, that I would never marry. I really said, you know, I'm the ugly stepsister. I have beautiful sisters, by the way. I'm kind of the ugly duckling of the family. And so in a weird way, maybe I didn't sit back and wait for people to court me. I was...
She may be ugly, but she sure can cook.
Yeah. It is a shock to see yourself on film, but what I tried to do was see, well, am I doing the right things? Am I generating warmth, you know, towards the audience? And I enjoyed being part of something that was larger than myself. I enjoyed being part of that large band and feeling that I was watching that band just as much as the audience was. I was enjoying it like it was a show for me, too.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank
thing.
You, Terry.
Bassist Tina Weymouth and drummer Chris Franz of the bands Talking Heads and Tom Tom Club. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be rhythm and blues musician, band leader, and songwriter Johnny Otis. He launched the careers of Jackie Wilson, Etta James, and Esther Phillips. There's a new collection of the sides he made for Capitol Records, including his 1958 hit, Willie and the Hand Jive. I hope you can join us.
Rockin' Billy. He can walk and stroll in Susie Q and do that crazy hand jive too. Papa told Willie, you'll ruin my home. You and that hand jive has got to go. Willie said, Papa, don't put me down. They're doing that hand jive all over town.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Shields is all too aware of what he calls the oppressive power of words. Like the main character in his new novel, Shields has a stutter. He's come to think of his stutter as representing the difficulty of all communication. Coming up, we talk to David Shields. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is just back from this year's New Music America Festival, and he plays us some highlights. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the latest installment in the public TV documentary series POV. It's called Girl Talk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Anti-government protests continue today in Czechoslovakia, with about 200,000 people marching in downtown Prague. NPR's Deborah Amos in Prague has more on the story.
Demonstrators tried to march to an old medieval castle tonight where the president, Gustav Husák, resides. Riot police fanned out across two bridges in the city and forced the marchers back towards Wenceslas Square. However, there were no violent confrontations with police. Demonstrators called for the resignation of the Communist Party leader Miloš Jakeš, a call repeated today by a new opposition coalition called Civic Forum. Jakeš appealed for calm in an official statement. He said the party was ready for change. However, the country's leading dissident, Václav Havel, said he had had secret contacts with Communist Party members. Havel told a news conference that there is a struggle in the party, not over whether Jakeš will resign, but who will replace him. In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
According to a new survey, fewer West Germans are in favor of reunification with East Germany now than before the Berlin Wall was opened. The survey, conducted by a West German television station, appeared to reflect growing concern among West Germans over the influx of millions of East Germans. An estimated 3 million East Germans crossed the border over the last weekend, and 275,000 have immigrated to West Germany since January, competing with West Germans for scarce housing and jobs. The East German currency hit new lows today as large numbers of East Germans continue to take shopping trips across the border to West Germany. Deidre Berger reports from West Berlin.
After trading at 10-1 last week against the West German mark, the exchange rate today for the East German mark dropped to 25-1 at some banks. This did not discourage East Germans from continuing to cross the border into West Germany. More East German tourists came today than yesterday on Sunday. Meanwhile, it was revealed that East German Premier Hans Modrow wrote a memo to European leaders at a summit in Paris this weekend. Modrow expressed the hope East Germany would be able to work with all European community institutions as a partner, not just as an observer. Modrow said East Germany considered the internal European market of 1992 a challenge and a chance for East Germany. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in West Berlin.
East German leader Egon Krenz today met with a West German diplomat for talks expected to center on an offer from Bonn to help out its communist neighbor's economy in exchange for moves toward a free market system. More than 100,000 people demonstrated in Leipzig calling for free elections and an end to the Communist Party's 40-year-old hold on power. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down 20.5 points to close at 2,632.04. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In 1979, a 10-day festival called New Music New York was held at a performance space called The Kitchen in Lower Manhattan. From that, an annual festival known as New Music America evolved. Every autumn, it's held in a different American city. This year's festival, which returned to New York for the first time, has just concluded. It was hosted by the Brooklyn Academy of Music and several smaller venues. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead, who is attending his third New Music America, has mixed feelings about the event in general and this year's 10th anniversary edition in particular.
There was some very good music at the 10th New Music America. There should have been, with well over 50 concerts held in 10 days. Still, there were reasons to complain. New York is as ethnically diverse as cities get, but the audiences at almost every show I attended were overwhelmingly white, which is a reflection on the narrow cultural base of most of the music. New York is a Latin music capital, but there were only 3 performances spotlighting Latin musicians. One headlined by the great salsa bassist Cachao, the others by non-Hispanics, composer Kip Hanrahan and pop star David Byrne. No one defines what new music is at these affairs, because so much stuff that's booked doesn't fit any sensible definition of it. I was glad that Chicago's Ed Wilkerson got enough corporate money to bring in his crackling big band, Shadow Vignettes, but their sound owes a lot to 1930s swing music. Much of the best music came from composers and performers who've been working in the same vein for decades. One festival highlight was hearing the superhuman player piano music of Conlon Nancarrow, who began punching out his piano rolls in the 1940s. Nancarrow's music touches on one interesting thing about this year's New Music America, the clash between high and low tech in the work of many musicians. In New York, Nancarrow's compositions were performed on computer-controlled pianos with help from composer and instrument maker Trimpin. Composer Paul Lansky also combined the homespun and high tech. His computer piece, Small Talk, began when he taped a casual conversation he had with his wife one morning. Lansky then converted the pitches and rhythms of their talk into electronic music. Its rhythm is unlike any composition I know. The best set I caught was a rare appearance by Musica Electronica Viva, the quintet of pianist and composer Frederick Rzewski, synthesizer players Richard Teitelbaum and Alvin Curran, soprano saxophonist Steve Lacey, and trombonist Garrett List. Their improvisations mix the craggy electronic music of the 1960s with the polyphony of Dixieland. From minute to minute, you never knew where they were headed. In one sense, free improvisation is the only music that's literally new because it's created on the spot. But even free music has a sense of history. The interplay of the Alabama duo Transmusique, violinist LaDonna Smith and guitarist Davey Williams, often carries echoes of rural blues. Smith and Williams have played together for 16 years. They know each other so well, they can anticipate each other's moves. English keyboardist Steve Beresford took a different approach. He assembled a trio with two musicians he'd worked with individually, but who'd never met each other before. American synthesizer player Dennis Palmer and French soprano saxophonist Michel Deneda. Their free music was an invigorating clash of styles. In the New Music America brochure, composer and saxophonist John Zorn attacked the annual festival's habit of placing established artists in big concert halls and lesser-known mavericks in small, out-of-the-way places. Transmusique and Steve Beresford played at the cozy performance space Roulette. The Brooklyn Academy of Music hosted overblown shows like Kip Hanrahan's, where big-name Latin and jazz musicians were brought together but given nothing interesting to do. The Academy also put on an appallingly dull program of new works for chamber orchestra. New Music America gets a little bigger and slicker each year, and every year it becomes apparent that a big and respectable festival of radical music is an absurd contradiction in terms.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. This is Fresh Air. Jeremy Zorn, the protagonist in David Shields' novel Dead Languages, is a stutterer. So is Shields. On the first page of the novel, Jeremy says, "We all choose a calling that's the most radical contradiction of ourselves." Shields says that Jeremy's words describe his own choice to become a writer.
I think there's something about the relationship between stuttering and writing. They're both situations in which words have a kind of violent, ecstatic poetry to them. And so I think that much of the book to me is about the connection between stuttering and writing, that in both cases you're simultaneously loving but also hating the oppressive power that words can have upon your life.
You've written that when you were in college and going to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, that you'd spend part of the day in the writing workshop building and then another part of the day in the speech therapy building.
Right.
Was your speech therapist and were your teachers at the Writers' Workshop aware of each other?
I think people at the Iowa Speech and Hearing Clinic, of course, knew that I was a graduate student at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but I sort of kept it relatively secret, I think, from the workshop that I was a patient in the Iowa Speech and Hearing Clinic. But I think clearly the novel was born there. I was just quite fascinated and at times, I suppose, depressed by this sort of hilarious contradiction that in both places, these four-story, and still are, I suppose, these four-story brick buildings, and both seem to be sort of houses of language, places in which you concentrated on language to a certain extent to the exclusion of life. You're trying to figure out your life through words. And I was just struck by, on the one hand, I was trying to use language beautifully and poetically and sort of in a sort of pleasurable way. And in the other building, I was just trying to say cat correctly. And so there was a sort of, on the one hand, I felt like I was about 6 years old, and on the other hand, I felt like I was, you know, a sort of would-be writer. So that contradiction that between being a sophisticated user of language and a really remedial user of language struck me as two parts of my own soul that I've always struggled with and been fascinated by, and somehow wanted to write a novel that expressed that contradiction.
Let me ask you to read an excerpt of your novel, and this is a passage that really directly confronts how it makes you feel about language when you stutter.
This is from the beginning of chapter 6. I had gotten it into my head that because my interlocutor never knew what I was going to say, and once I said it, he never understood exactly what I meant. It was incumbent upon me to underscore the impossibility of human communication by stuttering. I actually believed that. I thought it was my duty to insert into every conversation the image of its own absurdity. Worse than that, I came to think all fluent speech was, quote, fascistic, a word I had learned from mother, was an assertion of authority in the one enterprise in which any assertion of authority struck me as ludicrous.
I think as a writer, you've been able to turn stuttering into something of a metaphor.
That was certainly my intention. What do you think it's a metaphor for you? Or I guess that's something I should answer.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that.
Well, to me, it's really a metaphor for human communication generally. Everyone in the book, virtually every character from major characters to minor characters, has what I would call a kind of disguised stutter. And so much of what the book is about is how hard it is to communicate your true self by speaking or through language. And I think what Jeremy sort of slowly realizes in the course of the book is that he's not the only person who stutters. I mean, he has the sort of stupidity to actually dramatize it by stuttering badly, but that everyone in the book and virtually everyone in life, by virtue of being human, has trouble using language to communicate their true self. And I think once you realize that, you start giving yourself a slightly less hard time and start to understand how difficult things are for virtually everyone to use language in a completely communicative way. And so to me, stuttering really becomes a kind of metaphor for really the difficulty of human communication generally.
Do you have words that are trouble spots for you, particular sounds?
Uh-huh. Primarily, words starting with vowels seem to be almost exclusively the words that I tend to have trouble on.
Now, does that have any carryover in your writing?
Well, I think that it does, actually. I mean, I think I tend to love sound much more than most writers. I'm sure you're aware of sort of the contemporary vogue of minimalism, which thankfully is sort of slowly coming to a kind of grinding halt now, but minimalism tends not to pay much attention to the sound of words, tends not to be written in a very dramatic, loud-voiced way. And I, as a stutterer, feel a tremendous burden when writing to make language really fly, to make the language really take off as a sound system. And so I think it really has had a really quite a huge effect on the kind of writing that I like to read and the kind of writing that I like to try to write. Specifically, I try to write in which the language really takes quite high precedence and specifically has a kind of poetical stuttering about it. I mean, most of the sentences in the book have a kind of buried stutter to them, and that's quite intentional.
When your new book was published, did you have to decide whether or not you were going to do interviews? I don't know how self-conscious you still are about stuttering.
Uh-huh.
And I always think, gosh, you know, on radio, all you have is your voice. You know, it's like
right.
All people know about you is the way your voice sounds. And sometimes that's to your advantage and sometimes it's to your disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you had decided to be self-conscious about that, not to worry about that. Like, what, do you know what I mean? Like, what your attitude was going to be about...
Well, that's a very good question. I think, you know, it just seems to me that, you know, there are sort of two approaches. One, just simply never go out of the house, you know, and don't, you know, talk. But that just seems to, in fact, kind of exacerbate the stutter. And instead, I'm a full-time teacher of creative writing, and I just think the more I've gone out and spoken, the better control I have over my speech, as opposed to half a dozen years ago in which I simply used every excuse I could to avoid speaking in public, didn't give readings, would have students read passages in class, and all these kind of crutches I would rely on. And the more I've done things like give readings or show up on radio or teach in a class and don't avoid speaking a lot, kind of hard to teach without speaking. I just feel like it's simply reduced a lot of the anxiety I felt and has simply made me a better speaker and a better teacher and just a more, you know, communicative person, I suppose, or something like that. I just think it's good for my speech to not avoid situations and simply try to gain control over them and speak well in them.
David Shield's novel, Dead Languages, is published by Knopf. John Faddis playing Whisper Not on Fresh Air. Let's see what they're working on at All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. 100,000 people have demonstrated in Prague, Czechoslovakia, calling for an end to communist rule in that country and for free elections. The New York Times has reported that former East German party chief Erich Honecker was in favor of using armed force to put down demonstrations in Leipzig in East Germany, the so-called Chinese solution. The man who was to become the party chief, Egon Krenz, countermanded that order. NPR's Linda Wertheimer talks with three Republican women who are leaders in their party, urging the GOP to reevaluate its position on the abortion issue. Also, critic Bob Mondello reviews the new film, Henry V.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, the public television documentary series POV is airing Girl Talk. POV stands for Point of View, and TV critic David Bianculli says Girl Talk has a distinct one.
I'm Pinky. I'm 14 years old. The people in court are looking for me because I don't go to school. They want to put me in lockup. I run away a lot.
My name's Mars. That's my mother's tacky sense of humor. And I left home when I was 13 because my stepbrother raped me. And I didn't try and find my real father because he was going to have me raped anyway, according to my mother. So I ended up being on the street, living in a lot of different places. And now I live in Boston and I work as a stripper.
My name is Mata. I've had a pretty screwed up life. I've lived in foster homes, group homes, runaway shelters. Basically, I've been on my own since I was 12 years old and since. And I'm getting ready to move into my own apartment to have a new life.
All of these girls are runaways, and all of them have found a common home in Girl Talk. It's a documentary that allows them to express themselves and to come to terms with their past, present, and future. Filmmaker Kate Davis, who made Girl Talk when she was only 26, obviously got these girls total trust and cooperation. These are conversations or confessionals, not interviews. And one of the program's strengths is its willingness to mix the shocking with the superficial. Even the girls' daydreams, though, mean something. As when Pinky, crouched on a fire escape, fantasizes about marriage. Or, more accurately, marriages.
If I was to get married, I'd make sure I get married twice. Because my favorite color is pink. And the first time I get married, I wear white. The second time, I want to wear pink. So I'll get married twice if I get married.
Martha, one of the other girls in Girl Talk, doesn't have much time for fantasy. Her reality is too overwhelming. She's 7 months pregnant when the film begins, and by the time she has the baby and brings him home, she's comfortable enough with the camera to be frank about her life as a single teenaged mother.
Like the other day, last week, I was really upset about something. And I had a lot in my mind, and he was just crying and crying and crying and crying. And whatever I did, it wouldn't stop. He couldn't stop, and I felt so bad because there was nothing I could do, and he was still crying. Just sometimes I feel like I'm not a good mother, and I'm too young.
Finally, there's Mars, who tells stories of being sexually abused as a young girl, and who acts out some of her feelings and hostilities by working at a strip joint. Dressed in a schoolgirl outfit complete with lollipop and tricycle, she dances and strips to a very revealing piece of music. This is the part of Girl Talk that's causing all the controversy because of the nudity and suggestiveness. But hey, this isn't Flashdance, folks. There's no glamour in Girl Talk, not anywhere. Just three girls who tell sad stories but are happy that someone wants to listen. Girl Talk is by no means a complete portrait of these young women. Many aspects of their lives go unmentioned or unchallenged. But on a series called POV, that's totally appropriate. It's a sympathetic documentary, and most likely these girls will get your sympathy.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Bob Alls, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet rhythm and blues musician, bandleader, talent scout, songwriter, and producer Johnny Otis. Also, actor Jerry Orbach tells us about his latest role in Woody Allen's new movie, Crimes and Misdemeanors. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.